From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, April the 30th, 2020, and thank you very much for joining us this morning. Got a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking with Dick Sears, a senator, a longtime senator, a Democrat from Bennington County. He's the chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Vermont Senate, and he is also on the Appropriations Committee. Both committees have been very busy lately, of course, in their strange and unprecedented, really, legislative activities where they're all meeting virtually these days, mostly. And we'll be talking with him a little bit about what the legislature has been up to. Also wanted to get his perspective as somebody who lives in southwestern Vermont. He might have some thoughts to share with us about the continuing work by the Agency of Transportation to monitor cars coming into the state and where they're coming from. That's an interesting development in the wake of the coronavirus crisis, of course. And we want to find out a little bit about all that from Senator Sears. In the second half hour of the program, we're going to be talking with Tracy Dolan. She is with the Vermont Health Department, actually deputy commissioner there, and she's going to be updating us on some of the new pronouncements from the administration as of yesterday about the coronavirus response in Vermont. And we're also going to be talking later on in our Seeds to Society segment, second hour of the program, with Barrett Halverson and Gordon Clark about the University of Vermont Extension Services Master Gardener Program, and should be an interesting conversation there. It is springtime, and a lot of folks are getting out in the garden, so good timely programming there, I think. And let's get right into it with Senator Sears, who I believe is on the phone with us from his district down there in Bennington County. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, given the situation.
Yeah, that's a weird situation, that is for sure.
It sure is.
Hey,
yep.
I wanted to check in with you to find out a little bit about, first off, what your Judiciary Committee has been up to. You were telling me yesterday you're expecting to have some more fiscal information about where the state stands as of tomorrow. As a member of the Appropriations Committee, I think you're going to be hearing with one of the legislature's economists. So let's start with a little legislative update here. What has the Judiciary Committee been doing recently?
Well, the Judiciary Committee has passed two bills that I believe have been signed into law by the governor. The first had to do with the ability to update or file a will during this pandemic. And a lot of people are looking to change or have a will. And the law required witnesses, a notary public, and others. So we allow this to be done remotely by video. So we during the pandemic, and that was the first bill. The second bill we passed had to do with a number of judicial items, most of them having to do, again, with being able to pay rent into escrow and not being forced if you didn't have the money. These are people who have made arrangements. They're having a disagreement with their landlord. They're paying escrow money into an account until the disagreement is settled. This would allow the court to say, you, instead of shall pay, you may pay. Obviously, some people can't afford it in the middle of this pandemic. The second is similar to the wills issue, allowing a power of attorney for deeds and other items, once again, as long as done video. Some of the other requirements are would be the presence of a defendant in court, which allows to be done by video arraignments and so forth. It also it suspends the time frames for statute of limitations, and that's if you are in a situation where there's a statute of limitations for a lawsuit, for example, and it runs out during the pandemic and you can't get into court to make a filing, it gives you 120 days after the emergency order is terminated by the governor. And there's a few other things there in that bill. So it's pretty general. We also are looking at the Department of Corrections. You know, and there's been a lot of discussion about prisons and how they are, you know, obviously the St. Albans situation. So we've looked at that. The Department of Corrections has actually reduced its population down to a little under 1,400 people incarcerated, and that includes the people in Mississippi. And the numbers were, at the start of this year, were in the, just around 1,700. So it's a significant reduction to try to prepare for the pandemic and to try to get people out who are either significantly vulnerable. But it was also, I must add, that a lot of the people who are still incarcerated, the vast majority, are fairly violent offenders. And so and the effort was not only by the corrections department, by our courts, by the state's attorneys, and others involved.
Yeah, well, there's a lot.
A little bit about what judiciary's been up to.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I must say, I guess it was about a month and a half ago or so, very near the beginning of this whole crisis, really, when I was talking with our legal analyst, Dan Richardson, a very active attorney in Montpelier, and he was talking about the situation with wills, and a lot of people were suddenly thinking, you know, what about my will? Because obviously there was a lot of reporting going on that this is a very potentially fatal disease, and I think a lot of people out there had the same thought, which was, well, my word, what if I get it? How, you know, what kind of shape are my affairs in and that sort of thing? And he was saying there was a lot of concern among those folks and attorneys in Vermont that there wasn't really a good method for getting that done with the courts shutting down and so on and so forth. And so you have basically created a new way for this to happen. And I guess what's the old saying? Where there's a way, there's a will. No, yeah, I got that back. Yeah,
I think it's somewhat backwards, but, but we provided the ability to, as best as possible, and there's always potential for some kind of abuse of a system like this, but as best as possible, we're protecting the rights of people to do what they need to do in terms of deeds, in terms of wills, and other things one needs notarized in the middle of a pandemic when you just can't go to the lawyer's office, sit down with a witness and the lawyer and other people and put your affairs in order. This allows you to do it. It has to be by video and audio. It can't be just one or the other.
So. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So virtual sort of probably a Zoom meeting or something like that, sort of like what the legislature's been doing recently. And your mention of the correction system also interesting because obviously there's been a lot of concern there with the outbreak in the Northwest State Correctional Facility in particular up in St. Albans, and then the move of inmates over to St. Johnsbury. And I was interested in getting your thoughts about that. Do you think that was well handled by the executive branch?
I think, given the situation, it was handled as well as could possibly be handled. When I look at what's happened in some other states, particularly looking at Ohio, for example, where nearly half of the offenders are and staff have tested positive, but, you know, they did a terrific job, and all the way from Interim Commissioner Jim Baker down to the line staff, as well as offenders who have pitched in to help too. I commend all of them. It's not been an easy situation for anybody, particularly when you're isolated, you're ill, and so forth. And it's hard to social distance when you're in a cell with somebody else.
That is for sure.
I think they have done an admirable job, and I think it sometimes goes unrecognized, the work that some of these folks do that are on the front lines. We obviously are in contact with healthcare professionals. We're in contact with people at our grocery stores and others, but I think sometimes we forget some of the folks who are working on the front lines.
My guest is Senator Richard Sears, Democrat of Bennington County, Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and we welcome listener calls. 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 877-291-8255 and or 291-TALK. And if you have any questions or comments you would like Senator Sears to hear, he's here for another 15 or 20 minutes or so here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And really appreciate you joining us this morning, Senator. I wanted to shift gears a little bit here, though, and ask you about just give us a preview, because I guess just a little later today you're going to be hearing from Tom Cavett, the economist who frequently advises the legislature about the state's fiscal condition. And our vague impression is the state's fiscal condition in the face of this coronavirus pandemic is not good.
It is not good, Dave. And I'm, you know, first I think we need to recognize the number of deaths nationwide and people who have been killed in this virus, but also the economic toll. Mm-hmm. I saw on the news before we came on that the new jobless numbers are 30 million and out of work, and also about an 14 million who can't get through to their state unemployment offices to file their claims. So it may be as many as 40 million Americans out of work, and that's a staggering number. And it's also the economic loss. So we're looking at a general fund in the fourth quarter of down by about $230 million. And that's a sizable amount. An education fund down by about $70 million, and a transportation fund down by $42 million. So you're looking at real dire straits for the state's budget and how we deal with it. We're going to, hopefully, we've got help from the federal government in the form of the CARES Act to help some of the unexpected expenses. And we've also had, we're in pretty good shape. We had from the third quarter, we're still ahead by about $32 million. So the total loss and the total down in our revenues for fiscal year 20, which ends July 30th, is about $310 million. So, and that's a huge sum in a small state like this. But we're actually in better shape than most states fiscally. So hopefully the federal government will pitch in and help the states and our communities. One of the things that I think we all worry about is with an education fund that's down by $73 million total, we are facing huge property tax increases that people at this point just couldn't afford. So how do we, as a state, come through for the property taxpayer at the same time as our, the funding? For example, rooms and meals and sales and use taxes are down by almost about $55 million. So if you take that total, and those are all education fund monies, that has to be made up somehow. And obviously you don't want to put that $55 million on the property taxpayer.
That would be a pretty tough pill for a lot of Vermonters to swallow, especially in these times when household budgets are so torn asunder by layoffs and folks who are unable to make their usual living, the gig economy or whatever else.
I know that, I've certainly heard my share from my constituents about reopening the economy, stopping this and getting moving and so forth. And I think we all want to get to that point. But I would point out that within 3 to 3.5 hours of my home, over 20,000 people are dead. That's a staggering number when you think about it. That's between Massachusetts and New York. I'm about 3.5 hours from New York City and about 3 hours from Boston from my home. And so I was driving to Williamstown, Mass. Yesterday to drop off some things at the UPS store. And I got to thinking, just in Williamstown, Mass., little town, little college town. It was pretty much empty. And there's over 81 cases there in that little town. So there's over in Massachusetts and New York, there's over 350,000 positive tests. So when we think of it in those terms of what Vermont is surrounded by, and I don't know the numbers in New Hampshire. We're on the Mass-New York border here.
Right,
so our
right.
focus has mainly been on those two states. But when you look at those factors, you recognize how unbelievable the situation is. It's not just economic, but it's loss of life that's incredible.
Yeah, and in fact, I've been kind of curious, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but if you look at, I think I saw in the Boston Globe over the weekend that that Massachusetts' death toll had topped 3,000.
Yeah, they were 3,400 today.
Okay, and you know, Vermont's had about 50 deaths, and Massachusetts is about 11 times the population of Vermont. So if you were just to guess by population, you might assume that Massachusetts had something like 600 deaths, but instead they've had it's more than 3,000. And I'm saying, what accounts for that giant difference there? Any sense of that?
Well, I think mainly is the inability to socially distance. I mean, I live many Vermonters live in private homes. Many of us live away from town centers. In Boston, for example, you're living in apartment buildings where you're going in. If you're going in and out of those apartment buildings, you're touching door handles, other things that may not have been sanitized. You also have certain groups who are not following social distancing. I think Vermonters have, by and large, been better at that. But I think there'd be opportunities to look back and how did Massachusetts and New York, how did they handle it? Why so heavy? I think it's mainly the large population density. Even in Vermont, the larger communities like Burlington have been hit harder than some of the smaller communities. I think Bennington itself, the town of Bennington's had like 10 cases, 10 or 12 cases, and the countywide were in the, in a 45 to 50 cases, positive tests. Obviously, testing doesn't tell us a heck of a lot because we need much more testing. I think in order to really get moving, you need two things. One's the vaccine, and the other is widespread testing. And I was glad to see that the governor's press announcement yesterday about ramping up testing.
That's we're going to be talking with Tracy Dolan, the Deputy Health Commissioner, about that in the second half hour of today's program. And a question I wanted to put to her, which I'll give a little preview with you, Senator Sears, is interesting essay on the Ethan Allen Institute website by an Amy Stevenson, who's a microbiologist by training, and she was talking about she thinks it's time to reopen the economy in general in Vermont, and her argument basically went to a lot of the pronouncements early on by Health Commissioner Mark Levine, by the governor, et cetera, were that we wanted to hold down the curve, flatten the curve and prevent any overwhelming of our hospital system in Vermont. And the argument here was that has been very well accomplished. We haven't had anywhere near the problems or the peaks that we were originally projected as sort of worst case scenarios or even medium case scenarios in Vermont, and so that basically we're way ahead of where we thought we would be in late April. Time to reopen the economy. What do you think of all that kind of line of thinking?
Well, it's time to loosen the spigot, as the governor would say, in many areas, but I'm particularly concerned about travel and tourism at this point. And I think we as a government need to do all we can to help our travel and tourism industry. That said, the numbers that I just talked about in terms of Massachusetts and New York, and then if you add New Jersey in there and Connecticut, our, you know, we reopen our lodging, we reopen all of those recreational activities. What happens? I know that upstate New York is planning on reopening, and I think we should be looking at what they're doing nearby us, but I'd be really concerned about an influx of people from, and I know I've heard this from many constituents, an influx from hotspots.
Yeah,
and I think we need to be very judicious in how we, you know, reopen our economy. I'd love nothing better than to see our restaurants and our motels full. Believe me. I'm not sure that we can afford to have to go back to the situation. And that's what I worry about. Maybe this new drug, all those things. But we have healthcare experts, and frankly, I've been impressed by Dr. Fauci, Dr. Levine, and other experts. And I'm kind of following their advice. They may be wrong. They may be overly cautious. But when I look at the figures that I just gave you from Massachusetts, 3,405 dead as of this last night. New York, 18,015 dead. I don't know the numbers in New Jersey, but when you look at those numbers and the number of positive tests in those surrounding states, this isn't even accounting for people coming here from Florida, et cetera. I guess that's my response to those. And I know I've heard from so many constituents on both sides of this. We're discussing whether or not certain traditional yearly functions that we have down here, are they going to be held? For example, the Bennington Battle Day Parade, which is a huge thing in Bennington, has been canceled.
That's August, right?
That's August, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very, very tough call. I don't know what the proper answer is. I saw this essay on the Ethan Allen website, and I thought, well, there's a question to just throw out there and see what people are thinking, because obviously, let's look at this kind of from the other end of the telescope for a moment, and the national figures are really not good for the United States. I did a little math over the weekend and figured out that if at the time the United States had just reported, I think, about 54,000 deaths to date. And I looked at the Johns Hopkins website. That university in Baltimore is really probably the leading of this stuff that the media are all relying on for sort of what the daily tallies are and so on. And Johns Hopkins was reporting a per capita death rate in the United States more than twice, like 2.5 times the level in Germany. And so I did the math, and I figured out if we had had Germany's per capita death rate, we would have had about 24,000 deaths as opposed to 54,000 as of this past weekend. And so I thought to myself, well, what accounts for the extra 30,000, more than, 30,000 deaths? And remember, that's 10 times what we lost on 9/11. This is serious business. So what accounts for those extra 30,000 and some odd deaths? And I'm just wondering, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, the lack of federal leadership, to me, is the major cause. So each state for itself, each state deciding what to do, the wasted time telling us there wasn't a problem. Well, we all want to believe there's not a problem. And I think that clearly the lack of testing, the lack of information out of the federal government has been abysmal. You compare it to other events that may not be the same. Obviously, this is a once every 100-year event. I think you learn a little bit better from history, and the lack of leadership in Washington is the why it's where it is. You're probably correct that there would have been, and as tragic as 20, it's a lot worse at 60,000 or wherever we're headed. But I, I do want to mention one thing when we talk about reopening. I think we have to really do something about making sure our kids are taken care of. And by that, I mean, our focus should be on how do we reopen schools? How do we reopen places for kids to have recreation? I think the long-term impact, that would be my focus as the first group to reopen, would be trying to get schools back in session, even if it's a little earlier, even if it's in August. Find that this remote learning is not helpful for parents or for I've heard from parents who are friends who are now appreciating teachers more than ever, trying to homeschool kids.
Well, so. Interesting thought on which to conclude, Senator Dick Sears from Bennington, Democrat, Chair of the Judiciary Committee. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. We're about out of time, but I really appreciate you taking some time with us, Dave. Alrighty. Let's go to the bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple of words from our sponsors. We'll be back shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and I want to introduce our next guest. Tracy Dolan is the Deputy Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health, and the Vermont Department of Health, of course, has been pretty much the lead agency. Many, many other arms of state government are sort of looking to the Department of Health for guidance on how they should be responding to the coronavirus crisis. Dr. Mark Levine, the commissioner of the Department of Health, has been a regular fixture at the three times a week news conferences being led by Governor Phil Scott these days. There was one yesterday. There'll be, I guess, another one tomorrow. They seem to come Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And the news out of yesterday's news conference was interesting, and I thought I'd get Tracy Dolan, the Deputy Commissioner of the State Department of Health, to tell us a little bit about what the latest is. And Tracy, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
And what I understand, the key word from yesterday is testing. Tell us about that.
Sure, testing and tracing. Can I start with giving you kind of just the statistics of where we are right now in Vermont?
Oh, absolutely, sure. Yep.
Okay, sure. So we're currently at 862 cases, 862 positive cases. We have 11 people hospitalized, 15 hospitalized under investigation. We have had 47 deaths, and we've tested a total of about 15,429 people. And yesterday we had a kind of significant day where we had zero new positive cases. That won't be the same for today, but we had zero positive cases and zero deaths yesterday. So that was an exciting day. It's not a trend, but it is exciting that it's the first time since early March that we've had that.
Wow, that is something to celebrate, I think. And let me ask you, I mean, are we close to zero on other recent days?
There are some days when we've had several days where we've had under five or six. So we've had a few days where we've only had three or four. And again, you know, the number of people we're testing has been going down, in part because we have up until now primarily been testing people with symptoms. And with all of the social distancing and staying at home we're doing, people are just not around each other as much. And so they're much less likely to be getting sick really from anything, including from COVID-19. But anything else that's infectious and transmittable is also fairly low. So our incidence right now, from what we can see, is low. And because the governor wants to open up, and of course we all want to open up, I mean, you know, the economic hit has been huge, obviously, and the social hit, we're going to really go out and proactively seek out COVID cases so that we can ensure that we're getting all of them and we're isolating and we're doing the contact tracing. So I can speak a little bit to the testing. Mm-hmm. So over the next months, we're going to really ramp up the testing. We're starting out really trying to seek out even those who are mildly symptomatic, so not even very sick, but mildly symptomatic. Now, that is the current instruction to medical providers out there. If you have people who even have mild symptoms that might be consistent, please refer them for testing. We're also going to start more aggressively testing in all of the long-term care facilities, both those who have no COVID and those long-term care facilities where there might be a COVID case. So we're going to do both of those. Healthcare personnel, anyone who is involved in outpatient electives or who have had any kind of exposure, you know, really continuing to push that more aggressively. And then among children, we've already said, you know, if children have symptoms, please refer them. And so we're really going to continue to push that message, even mild symptoms in children. And then finally, we would like to be testing more Department of Corrections staff and inmates. We have tested where we've had a positive case, but we may move to more proactively now testing. So that's kind of our early, that's kind of the wave one. Wave two, we start doing more patient testing before procedures for outpatient, more healthcare personnel. We move on to home health and hospice workers and to first responders. And then wave three, when we expand even more, we're going to be looking at people coming in for summer residents from out of town, child care mm-hmm. providers, and again, continuing to expand inpatient testing. So we've kind of got some waves. We've got a broad plan. Now our team this week is hammering that out. So along with testing, we also get into contact tracing. We've been doing contact tracing throughout, and so that means if you're positive, we reach out to you and we find out who you've been in close contact with. And then we reach out to them and we provide advice to them or refer them for testing as needed or refer them for isolation depending on the exposure. And so we're going to ramp that up. So every time we find a case, we're really going to track it down with contact tracing and ensure that we're providing the right instructions there too. We really want to isolate and contain as much as we can. Now that we have this low incidence, we want to find it and keep it low.
Yeah, wow, that sounds really pretty comprehensive, and it certainly is a different picture than we were seeing a couple of months ago when people who were who had flu symptoms were actually having trouble getting tested, as I recall. I mean, it would be, you'd go to the doctor and they'd say, well you know, we're very limited on the number of tests we have, and we are only testing people who come in from foreign hotspots, Italy or China or whatever, and that kind of thing. Much different picture now.
Yeah, it's really evolved, you know, and the CDC has evolved as we learn more about this virus. I mean, the more we learn about the morbidity and mortality related to the virus, mm-hmm. how sick people get or how many people die, and the more we learn about the transmission of the virus and the symptoms. I mean, early on, we understood that the symptoms were primarily fever, cough, trouble breathing, and while those certainly continue, we're learning that there are different symptoms now and more symptoms to look at. And so as we learn, CDC learns, and we mostly take our direction from CDC. So as CDC says, hey, this is who you should be testing now, we're getting out ahead. We're really one of the few states that are in this very fortunate position of having very low incidence and now seeking it out. In many states, even those who are symptomatic are not necessarily getting tested, and we have been very lucky to have amazing partners in healthcare. So we have a healthcare system that's been able to absorb it. We have not been in the emergency place that many states have. And then an amazing population that has really complied with stay home and stay safe. I mean, that's the difference. That's why we don't have a high number of deaths. That's why we don't have so many people sick. And that's a wonderful thing. And hopefully it helps us to slowly start open up.
I'm seeing online a little bit of a debate going on where some folks are saying that a lot of the stay home and stay safe stuff, the shutdown of the economy and so on, may have been a case of overkill Others are arguing that the reason we are doing so well is because we took those steps. Any sort of thoughts that, along those lines?
Yeah, I think the reason we're doing well is because we took those steps. I mean, all we have to do is look next door to Massachusetts. Massachusetts per capita has a rate that's about four times higher than we do in terms of deaths and sickness and positive cases. And so some of it is about population density, but we know, I mean, there isn't a guessing game here. We know across the country, we're literally seeing it spread in states and ravage some states and their healthcare systems. And that hasn't happened here. And it's not like we would wonder what happens. You know, we know, we look around and we see what's happening, even in some of the smaller states. And so I believe it is because we got in early. We didn't get in early chronologically. I mean, we were shutting down and asking kids to stay home from school, for example, when other states did. However, we did it with relatively few cases. You look up at Canada, you know, I'm from British Columbia originally, and my family mm-hmm. is in a small town, Prince Rupert, British Columbia up there. And I think there's one case in that town, and they have been shut down for weeks. In an effort to make sure it doesn't happen. So we're seeing other countries shutting down really early and really containing it in the hopes that they can then open back up more quickly. What we don't want to do is open up too quickly and then have to come back to this level of shutdown. If we can get ourselves in a good place, and I know it feels hard because we're already seeing low numbers and it feels like the weather's getting better, why can't we get out and mingle? But if we just stick to it a little longer and then slowly move into this opening up, then we can really track every case and keep this at a minimum. It doesn't mean if we get one case, we're shutting down again. What it means is let's continue to track it and stay on top of it so it feels more manageable.
One thing, I was talking with Senator Dick Sears just in the last half hour of the program this morning, and he is in Bennington County, of course, and you know, right on the border of Massachusetts and New York. And so I think he is very sensitive to looking at these neighboring states and seeing, you know, as he put it, there have been 20,000 deaths or more within 3.5 hours of his house. So he may be maybe more sensitive to this kind of thinking than a lot of the folks here in the WDEV listening area in central and northern Vermont. And I'm sort of wondering, actually, one of the things he said was that he is worried about any kind of a quick reopening of, particularly of our lodging and restaurant industries, because he worries that there'd be a sudden, as he put it, influx of people from the remaining COVID hotspots in the Northeast, including Massachusetts and New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. And is that something that where you folks are also giving some thought to that?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that's really one of our biggest worries. Because we know we can contain what we have here within our borders, it feels relatively manageable. When we think about people coming in, because, you know, we don't have, obviously, a border crossing with guards, et cetera, from other states like we do with Canada. And, that is a huge fear. We're asking people to isolate. We're going to be asking people to test coming through. But, it becomes challenging to enforce that because, of course, you can't know how many people are coming across, and we're going to really push that message, and hopefully we've got some positive peer pressure where people will feel like, you know, we already have a situation where there's some people who don't really believe in wearing masks, but when you go to the store and you're the only one not wearing a mask, you feel kind of silly. And I'm hoping that, you know, as people come across the border and their neighbors see them come in, hopefully that sense that you're supposed to isolate and get tested, hopefully we have some strong peer pressure there, because that is our biggest concern. Even with the colleges and universities, we've been talking to colleges and universities every week, and they are trying to figure out what to do. And one of the big concerns there is not so much the students right here in Vermont who will stay, but it's really the ones coming back in from other states. That's really the roll of the dice that we're not sure of, and where we have to have things ready.
That is a key question as well. In terms of wearing masks, my wife came back from the store a couple of days ago, and her and was just kind of gritting her teeth speaking ill, shall we say, of folks who were walking around the store without masks on and ignoring the distancing arrows in the aisles. You know, a lot of the stores now want you to do sort of go one way up and down the aisles. So these behavioral cues are being missed by some folks. Go ahead, and here's your moment, Tracy Dole, the Deputy Commissioner of Health. Shame them.
Yes. Okay. Well, you know, I would rather encourage them than shame them, and I'm sure that we all know people in our circles. I mean, I'm sure in your circle you have probably people who are absolutely compliant and recognizing this, and others who are sort of like, oh, you know, I can do without this, and I don't believe in it. And we all have that. But I have to say, even if it's not for you, even if you don't believe in it, you are absolutely putting others at risk when you go out like that. You know. Because, I mean, think of elderly people who do not have the immune system that you might have. Think of people who are touching. Think of healthcare workers in that store who might have to take care of other people. And what if you are asymptomatic, because you might feel great, even though asymptomatic doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to transmit, probably less likely, you could. And so by wearing a mask, you're protecting others from yourself, from something that you don't even know if you have. But we do know that some asymptomatic people do have coronavirus, COVID-19. And so put on the mask, trust science. I know things are changing all the time, and it's easy to say, well, they don't know what they're talking about. But we really do, and trust it, and please wear a mask, if not for yourself, then for others, and for our healthcare workers who are having to go in every day, and for our staff who work in long-term care facilities. I mean, those nurses out in the nursing homes are just rock stars. They're going into a really high-risk environment, particularly when there's COVID in their nursing home, and they're going in every day. So I really encourage you to wear a mask and think of others first. It's a little uncomfortable. It might even feel silly to you, but it saves lives. It's why we are where we are right now. The mask wearing, staying home, stay safe, hand washing, all of that is why we are in the place that we're in, the very, very fortunate place that Vermont is in right now.
Yeah, it's kind of a question. I think almost it's a public spiritedness or something. You know, a lot of Vermonters are proud to go to town meeting. They're proud to participate in elections. They're, you know, they're proud to volunteer in their communities, et cetera, et cetera. Just one more little thing here, putting on the mask. Now, one question I do have for you. I was getting a little warm in my car the other day. The sun was out, and I was thinking, boy, summer's coming. Are we going to be having a 90-degree days in August? Are we going to have to be putting on these darn masks?
You know, I think that using masks in congregate environments is probably going to last a little while. I have a friend over in China, and China released the requirement to wear masks in certain areas because a lot of the virus was localized in China. However, she says everyone's just wearing them anyway. It's just become part of what they're doing, particularly when they're out in crowds. Now, we're lucky in Vermont. There are a lot of places you go where there may not be crowds or may not be others, right? But there are going to be some places. And so if you're walking around outside and you're not around other people in August, you may not need a mask. You know, we'll find out and see how our viral activity is. But if you're going into a grocery store, pharmacy, somewhere indoors where there's a lot of people, then you might still need to wear a mask. But the idea that you would necessarily need to wear one outside later this summer, depending on our epidemic, you know, that remains to be seen. Certainly, if you're not near others, we still say that you don't need to wear a mask. If you're out walking or hiking or going for a run and you're on your own or working in your garden, of course, all of those things. I mean, we are lucky in Vermont. I mean, we could be in New York stuck where you can't get outside. There's no green area. You have to drive for hours. I do feel like we're a little bit luckier here. Of course, not lucky to be out of work, and I'm sorry for those folks.
And, of course, you know, maybe people start regarding these masks as a bit of a fashion statement. I see the governor with his camo mask, you know, rocking the hunter motif, and others with American flag masks, and et cetera.
Yeah, I saw a guy the other day who had almost like a Vincent van Gogh, like Starry Night mask on.
And, there you go.
And I said, nice mask. And I thought, is that what we're going to be doing? Or are we going to be complimenting people's masks, you know? I even saw a trikini. It's a bikini with a matching mask that you can get.
Wow. Huh. That's,
I know. That's,
so when we talk about summer, that may be the coming thing this year. Who knew? But
you want to get in. You want to get in on that early, Dave. It's called a trikini. They might sell.
Okay,
out,
I'll have to.
So.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I don't follow the fashion magazines that closely, but I guess that's a good tip for those who do. Anyway, this is fascinating stuff, and I'm just wondering in terms of the. Dick Sears was saying, Senator Sears, at the end of our interview a little bit ago, that biggest concern or the part of Vermont society he wants to see getting back into gear soonest, really, is schools and programs for kids. Any chance that the schools might resume before the normal end of the school year in June?
As far as I know, the schools won't be resuming before the end of June. However, we don't know yet about how things will go over the summer with summer camps. You know, if our rates stay low, maybe there is a way that we would be able to do some modified version of that. It might be, it might be something like, partial occupancy in some of these camps, or it could be really focusing more on outdoors. Who knows what that could look like? But I think, a month ago, because we had such high numbers of cases, it might have felt like nothing can happen, this summer. I'm hoping something can. I don't know what that's going to look like, but probably not for the school year at the end of this school year. I know we're gearing up to think about what the new school year will look like.
Yeah, that's and of course, a lot of our colleges are now really trying to plan for the fall as well, and wondering, yes, frankly, about enrollment numbers and that sort of thing. That's really a different environment than the public schools in that regard. And you said you were talking to colleges on a regular basis. What are you hearing from them out there?
Sure. So we talk to them every week, folks from Middlebury, St. Mike's, UVM, et cetera. And some of the things they're thinking about are June 1st leases, people coming back in, how to manage that. We've got people coming in from out of state. How are we going to manage that? And then in classroom versus online, maybe a mixture of that. Thinking about what kinds of students might be too high risk to be coming back and where we might want to steer them toward online, especially if they're immune compromised. Thinking about how to set up their school so that if they do have some illness, they'd be able to isolate and manage it. Thinking about meals right now, a lot of campuses just have like 100 or 150 students on campus because they can't go back to where they're from. And so they're managing meals as takeout. So they're thinking about, okay, if we have now thousands, can we still do it as a takeout environment so you don't have all the kids in the cafeteria? Sports, is it going to be reasonable to have a sports season at some colleges, given that when you're doing athletics, this is a higher risk activity in terms of the way you breathe and exhale. And so all of those things, I understand people's feeling of we don't want to overdo it, but boy, we don't want to underdo it. It just doesn't take much for it to bounce back. We know that this illness has an R-naught factor, which is the factor by which you pass it on, of above 2, something like a 2.5. So everyone who has COVID-19 approximately passes it on to 2.5 people, which is pretty high. So once it comes back, it takes off. So we want to be really careful.
We have a couple of callers on the line. Let's go to Nils in Duxbury. Good morning, Nils.
Good morning. Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd actually ask, can you guys hear me okay?
You sound like you're talking from the bottom of a bathtub, but give it a try.
Okay. Is that any better?
That's much better. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. I actually called your show a few weeks ago. You had a fellow on from either Seven Days or VT Digger. Pardon me for not remembering. The question I asked, and I've also contacted the governor's office with no response, and also my local representative, also with no response. The question is simple. It would be very helpful to hear a clear definition of quarantine, specifically regarding people coming back to Vermont, whether they're residents or coming up for the summer, versus the definition for, stay safe, shelter in place, self-isolate, because I don't think that's been made clear. Maybe I've missed something, but I have a feeling that it would be helpful, particularly as things move forward, to let people know returning here that quarantine means you don't leave your property. That's my assumption. But
let's ask Tracy.
Clarify that?
Sure. Tracy Dolan, what can you tell us about the definition of quarantine?
Yeah, for folks who are coming back up from out of state, we are recommending quarantine. I believe we're calling it self-isolation. I would have to check the language we're using right now. But that is not the same as stay home, stay safe. Stay home, stay safe for Vermonters is stay home, but if you have to get out and get something essential, wear a mask. For folks who are coming up from out of state, we are saying, you know, stay in your home and stay isolated from other people, because for that two-week period, you may be ill and you may not realize it, and you want to stay home for 2 weeks to make sure you don't have symptoms. So that really would mean utilizing some other service to get your groceries or to get something essential.
Right, but the point I'm making is, and I don't live under a rock. I do listen to the radio periodically, most every day. I don't think that's been made clear. And the governor talks about it. Dr. Levine talks about it. You just talked about it. And that's you're the first person I've heard since the beginning of this that said clearly quarantine means you don't leave your property. Bring a cooler with goodies. Have a neighbor bring you food from, you know, the market. Don't leave your property. Anyway, that's my point. And I think there's plenty of people out there, and I'm speaking directly about resort areas, that aren't getting that message.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Nils.
I appreciate the show.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And it's always good to clarify things, so that's helpful. Let's go to Irene in Montpelier. Good morning, Irene.
Hey, David. My daughter and I both feel that we might have had COVID, and we're both really interested in getting an antibody test. She's down in New York City. I'm up here. We spent time together in late February, early March, so if I had it, I probably got it from her.
Okay, let's ask Tracy Dolan about that. I've heard that antibody tests are I guess less in favor than they were a couple of weeks ago. What's the latest?
Yeah, so we would love to do antibody testing. The WHO just put out some information that indicates that the current antibody tests out there are fairly inaccurate. They have a pretty high false positive rate. So we're waiting for the FDA to recommend a particular test that we believe will have more accuracy. It doesn't help us if we run an antibody test that has a 40% false negative rate, for example, then, you know, it wouldn't give us much useful information. So we're waiting for a more positive, a more specific and accurate test. We do know New York went forward with their serology testing, antibody testing. Again, we don't have as much confidence as New York does in the particular test right now. We have a working group here in Vermont who looked at the current tests and recommended against it currently, but we are checking, you know, on a weekly basis to see if there's a better product out there. But once that comes available, that's something we would use. Probably less for individuals to say you have antibodies, and more possibly a representative sample of the population.
All right. Well, that's an excellent question to finish up with. I appreciate that, Irene. Thanks for the call. Tracy Dolan, Deputy Commissioner of Health, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you.
All right. Nice to talk to you. You take care. Bye-bye.
You too. We're going to go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News. Back with some more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We're back and continuing into our second hour on this Thursday morning, April the 30th, 2020. I'd like to bring in one of our national correspondents after the mid-show break. And joining us this morning is Steph Kite of Axios. Good morning, Steph. Thank you so much for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And I see on Axios, one of the top items here says, President Trump's handling of the coronavirus crisis has produced a political emergency for the White House, with a raft of signs suddenly pointing to possible big trouble when he faces re-election 6 months from now. What are some of these signs?
Yeah, so there are both national signs and also specific signs in specific states and areas of the country that will be important for the November election. You know, throughout his presidency, he's had a pretty steady favorability rating, but that has ticked down recently nationwide to 43%, where it was 49% in March. And so that's, you know, one big data point that President Trump is obviously watching. And that's something that, you know, he got upset about, as AP reported, going off on his campaign manager, Brad Parscale. But also you look at things like even in Florida polls in March, he was ahead in March, but now is a little bit behind Joe Biden in polls there. So these are all just specific data points that we know that the president and his campaign team are watching and don't bode well as we're getting closer to November.
One thing I wonder about is, the big story over the weekend was how the president had, and people have obviously described this in different ways, and there's a lot of dispute about how to describe it exactly, but, and the media get, you know, is, from his supporters have gotten a lot of the blame for this whole big blow up about disinfectants and being ingested or injected as a way to combat the coronavirus. For one thing, the president was the first one, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was the first one to use the words injection and disinfectant in the same sentence, right?
If he wasn't the first, he was one of the first. And, you know, of course, when you're hearing that from the president of the United States, I think there are people who are going to take it seriously, as we've seen.
Yeah, that's one of the amazing aspects of this thing is that, for instance, public health authorities from Maryland to California were reporting that they were getting a slew of phone calls from folks asking about the use of disinfectants in the treatment of the coronavirus after the president's remarks. And, you know, I saw a lot of chatter online, especially from people who tend to be supportive of the president, who were blaming the media for this. But my rough understanding of the situation is that a lot of the phone calls going to the public health agencies were just people who had seen the briefing and had seen the president's message, you know, pretty unfiltered at that point, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I think that was one of the reasons why we're seeing those daily coronavirus task force briefings peter out. They're not going to be having them as frequently as they were having them for a lot of different reasons. And one was that, like, it wasn't doing Trump any favors. He was getting up there and kind of speaking off the cuff. Of course, it was always more helpful when he was leaning on the other medical experts in the room. But when he didn't have much new news to report but was still staying on the stand and talking about these issues, we started seeing things like him talking about, you know, injecting with disinfectant, these other things that then the White House had to walk back. But the media, of course, does cover because their words coming from the President of the United States. But, of course, you know, it's not necessarily all the media's fault when the president is on live television saying these things.
Well, I think that's one thing that this president has been slow to understand is that a president's words actually carry more weight than the words of just about anybody else. In fact, I'm gonna withdraw the words just about from that sentence. It's just the nature of the job that if you're president of the United States and you say anything, people just put a lot of weight on those words by virtue of your office. Isn't that true?
It is true. And we've especially seen with President Trump supporters that they really do hang on every word that he says. He has a lot of sway with his base in particular. And for many of his supporters, they don't trust other media outlets who might have provided more medical expertise and kind of tempered the president's words. And so, of course, there is going to be those words are going to matter, and especially to the people who trust him and have voted for him, and especially in election year and in the middle of a pandemic where people expect that the president of the United States will be careful with his words in the middle of a crisis like this.
And one more thought about what might have contributed out of all this to some decline in his approval rating or whatever. His response on Friday where he came out and he said, hey, I was just being sarcastic and trying to get a rise out of the press. I was frankly shocked by that because it occurred to me that, you know, we're looking at a situation here then I think involving the deaths of more than 54,000 Americans. Remember, that's 20 times the number we lost on 9/11. And you know, sarcasm is generally equated with sort of being snarky. And I cannot remember a president in the past facing a giant national tragedy and being snarky about it. Can you?
Certainly not. And I do think it does play a role in people's viewing of the way he's handling this, that not only has he changed his stance multiple times about the dangers of coronavirus, not only did he not only was he slow to act in the beginning until it really was urgent, but also now he's, saying things that he's been walking back and having to explain as sarcasm. And it seems to be very much him defending his own words rather than addressing the problem at hand and addressing communities that have been impacted by this.
And talking about the ratings that these daily briefings were getting and so on, my sense is that the tone of his response, never mind the management of, are we doing the right things in terms of getting tests and getting equipment to the right places and all that sort of stuff. That's for another discussion. But I do think that the tone really matters here, especially once again from a president of the United States. And I think back to, the sort of tone adopted by President George W. Bush after 9/11, the last time the United States faced a truly just shocking disaster, and the tone of that president then, and that leaves aside entirely his decisions about war with Iraq and all and Afghanistan and all the rest of it, but his public presentation about what was going on, much different from this president, wouldn't you say?
Certainly, and of course, I think there is something to be said for the president being willing to talk to the American people on a daily basis when they're facing something like the coronavirus. And, I think that the tone often changed from day to day for each of those briefings, where at times it was helpful and he would bring on medical experts who could answer questions that the American people had. I think in the beginning, it was seen as a good thing that Trump was willing to go out there and talk to people and address the nation in the middle of this crisis and to bring along with him some of the experts who are working on this and to come up with a plan for reopening, which has generally been seen as relatively a good plan for states to be following. So, I think there were certainly elements of these briefings that were helpful. But again, like you pointed out, the tone wasn't always what I think the American people were looking for when they're very scared and seeing both the economic impacts and the health impacts on their communities. I think some of the briefings certainly did not strike the right note for a lot of them, and we're seeing that in the way that they're responding when we're looking at these polls.
And the other thing, obviously, here, the emotional toll, and people are seeing family members die and friends die, and they are, frankly, a lot of Americans, especially older Americans among Trump's most avid supporters, are worried about their own situation. Am I going to get the coronavirus kind of thing? I just, to watch a president get up there and talk about what kind of ratings his briefings were getting, I was sort of thinking to myself, come on, you really got to hit the right notes here. I don't know. Let's, if you have time, Steph, can we bring in a caller? There's a listener on the line.
Sure.
Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, listen, I'll just be real quick here. It's more of a quick statement. It's not a question at all. It's a quick statement. And that's there's no ambiguity as to whether or not Trump understands how the effect of his words on people. He knows it. He experiences it. That's why he holds those massive Nazi rallies that he likes to hold. So let's not have any pretensions that he actually doesn't know what the effect of his words are going to be. Anyway, thanks.
All right, thanks for the call, Rama. Well, Steph, on that happy note, I think I'll let you go for today. I appreciate you checking in with us. It's always good talking with you.
Yes, of course. Looking forward to next time.
All righty, thanks. Let's talk about some of what's happening out there. We have a couple of excellent guests lined up as part of our weekly Seeds to Society program, the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont. Even when the university is going virtual online, otherwise mostly shut down, they're still helping out the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV-FM every week with some material for a nice segment on the second hour of Thursday's show with a lot of discussions about agriculture, gardening, food, and all of the other things that go into keeping us well-fed and and keeping the love going for our natural life out there, our natural world out there. And my guests today are Barrett Halverson, who I believe is a returning champion. Barrett is an educational outreach coordinator for the University of Vermont Extension Master Gardener Program and oversees 500 volunteers statewide, as well as the yearly 13-week Master Gardener course and 6-week Master Composter training. Her focus is on promoting research-based home horticulture projects and practices that utilize sustainable gardening for healthy food, clean water and air, plant and soil biodiversity, and thriving pollinators and wildlife. Gotta love those bees. Barrett Halverson, thanks so much for coming back to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for having me. And just so you know, my name's actually pronounced Brett.
Brett. I think I might be looking at a misprint here. But anyway, okay. Sorry about that. That's right. I think you corrected me once before, and I apologize. One of these days it'll actually stick. How's that? Gordon Clark is a lifelong organizer and activist in peace, environmental, and food system issues. He was the National Executive Director of Peace Action, the nation's largest grassroots peace and disarmament organization. And he also worked for Ralph Nader's Public Citizen, ran for Congress as a Green in 2008 in Montgomery County, Maryland, founded the Montgomery Victory Gardens and Education and Advocacy Project, dedicated to building a more resilient and sustainable food system in Montgomery County. Then later moved to Vermont with his wife, Emily, and they live in Burlington, and still doing a lot of gardening here in Vermont's largest city. Gordon Clark, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
you nailed it, Dave. Good
okay. job. Anyway, I appreciate the two of you joining me this morning, and it's really good to talk about gardening. This is an ideal time of year. In fact, we're starting to get a few garden tools out around the old Graham homestead here in Montpelier. And so I'm wondering, first off, Brett, your coursework with the Master Gardener course and the 6-week Master Composter training, tell us how that's working. I gather it must be happening online. Is that right?
Yeah, we actually offer it online anyway. So mm-hmm. we're just sort of continuing as usual since we're reaching the whole state of Vermont. So
yeah, and
go ahead.
Historically, in normal times, had there been any sort of in-person upfront and personal, real face-to-face training there, or was it always all online?
It's always been online for at least the last mm-hmm. 4 years. And
I see.
We do in-person classes in the summertime as a way to add the hands-on piece.
Yeah, and what's going to be happening with those this year? Are they still on track, do we think, or are they going to be altered because of this current situation, or what's going on there?
Yeah, we're not sure. We're just kind of waiting to see what will happen. They're usually later in the summer, so we're hopeful that they'll still happen, but we're not sure yet.
Gordon Clark, in your biographical note here, I see that you're not only an avid gardener and peace activist and all these other things on your resume, but you also do stand-up comedy, I see here. Is that right?
I can see you're going straight to the most important line in my bio, Dave. Thank you.
Yes, and I'm hoping we can inject some comedy into a discussion about gardening, because I'm sure there are some funny stories to be told by both of you, actually. But there's always love a little wrinkle of humor in the whole situation here. So that's great. That's great, good to know as well. But
I'll do what I can.
Okay. And Gordon, are you involved in teaching any of the Master Gardener classes, or what's your connection with the Master Gardener program?
Yeah, well, I transferred my Master Gardener status, took the new tests when I arrived in Vermont 4 years ago, and I have been both writing articles for the Master Gardeners and doing occasional training. One of my favorite that I did a few times last year, Brett actually joined me a couple of times, is on low tunnel gardening. which is a way to erect simple low tunnels that can extend your gardening season for at least several weeks in either direction. So, yes, I do help out with the training at times.
And low tunnels, Brett Halverson, refresh me, because my sort of rough understanding of this, and I think you'll know from my next rather ignorant question, I'm not a master gardener myself, but low tunnels are sort of, are they at all akin to a greenhouse?
Yeah, you could think of it that way. It's kind of like a mini greenhouse, and it's typically made with some hoops or wire, and then you would throw some plastic or row cover over that. And you can typically throw that over a row of vegetables.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the vegetables most commonly grown in the low tunnel setting?
Well, typically it's used for season extension, so it would be a way to get your crops in a little bit earlier in the springtime, and then a way to kind of extend your season out in the fall. So really anything that you want to grow a little bit earlier, cool season crops like cabbage or spinach or broccoli, things like that, in the springtime, and then same kind of thing in the fall. Cool season crops that you want to extend the length of their growing period.
I think of one cool season crop that we've grown is kale, and I'm wondering, is that something that a lot of folks use, or for which a lot of folks use the low tunnel setting?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, kale, any kind of Asian green, lettuce, spinach, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And so when you say a little earlier in the spring, when are people typically getting into their low tunnels as opposed to being out in the garden?
Well, you know, it really depends on where you live in Vermont. So, mm-hmm. if you live up on top of a mountain, it would be a little bit later like I do. So, so right now I have some low tunnels over my spinach, but it's also inside of a greenhouse because the temperature is still getting down below 30 degrees at night. You know, down in the Champlain Valley, it might be very different. And Gordon can probably speak to, you know, what he has in his low tunnel down in Burlington.
Gordon, talk to us about that a little bit. You have low tunnels at your place?
Low tunnels. I'm growing bananas here and next to Lake Champlain. Are you kidding me?
You're in a banana belt, are you? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I doubt that.
I absolutely use low tunnels. Since I do live near Lake Champlain, it's a warmer, slightly warmer climate. We're in zone 5A for those who know their hardiness zone map. I'm, you know, definitely using the low tunnels for the same thing, starting crops. And although I was a little bit late here this myself, here you could easily get them out in March. Still going down a little, you know, by freezing at night, but with a low tunnel on it, you're going to do just fine, particularly plastic over row cover since plastic retains more heat. But, yeah, you can do it as early as that. And, you know, in terms of going into the fall, I have using a combination of a low tunnel and a high tunnel, which Fred has talked about, I've actually been able to keep my vegetables going until the beginning of January. So it's really amazing. Yeah, it's pretty amazing what you can do with just not that much covering if you put your mind to it.
Huh, that is interesting. Let's bring in a listener who's on the line this morning. I think Ted in Shelburne joins us. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, and thank you all. I did actually take a very early, a prototypical master gardener class, I think, a very long time ago. And with the low tunnels, I've been curious. We're getting pests becoming very obnoxious and in kale and, you know, onions and garlic and so on. And I'm wondering if the low tunnel is considered in that regard of keeping the pests outside and your food inside with some of those crops that may not really need it for climate control. I also listened to Alan Betz's full talk at the library. I listened to it online last night. And he spoke about the longer growing season that he has witnessed in Pittsford, I believe it was his home.
Yeah.
But I was interested, and I know some people can stay organic and grow tomatoes successfully with, you know, without sprays and so forth by actually doing it undercover. So that's just a topic of pest control by way of low tunnels and such. Thank you very much.
All right, we have a breakup coming, but let's get a quick answer here, if we could, from Brett Halverson. Brett, fill us in.
Yeah, I think it can be a great form of pest control, especially if you're using a row cover fabric. Those are also used as a way, organic farmers often use them as a way.
Well,
to control
I'm talking
pests
about low tunnels.
What about low tunnels?
Well,
as
I was
going
to say the low tunnel, the actually total sort of semi-transparent cover, as opposed to, I've never been, the remake covering and so forth and blowing and sitting on plants has never appealed to me. But the low tunnel is something that could be an almost necessity in some cases if you're having this, Swede midge, I think, is something that can spoil your kale crop. You know, and is very hard to combat. And I thought the low tunnel might work that way. Insect control. Anyhow, that's all. I was just thinking that it might be worthy of research and report or so on, and of some of us who are wanting to be organic and combat pests by physical barrier. Thank you very much.
Got it. Thanks for the call, Ted. Brett, you were saying it sounds like he wanted to focus really purely on the low tunnel method here. Am I following that distinction correctly?
Well, you know, low tunnel would essentially just be lifting the fabric up with some sort of wire or hoop, where sometimes mm-hmm. it's laid on the ground as well.
I see.
So it's kind of the same method, but just two different applications.
Yeah, fairly close difference. It sounds like there, but. We can talk about more about low tunnels and about other aspects of gardening and master gardening after we return from a bottom of the hour break. We're going to hear some CBS News, a couple words from sponsors here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Before I go to the break, I just want to remind you of all of our podcast. Don't forget, you can always go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link to the Dave Graham Show, scroll down a bit, and you'll come up with a list of our recent programs by guest and by topic, and you will be able to listen to your heart's content any hour of the day or night. Thanks to the Warren Store for sponsoring our podcast. We'll be back shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and my guests are Brett Halverson. She is State Program and Education Coordinator with the UVM Extension Master Gardener Program. And Gordon Clark is a Master Gardener with UVM Extension himself. And Gordon, talk to me a little bit about, I'm really curious about the low tunnel thing, and maybe it's because I'm thinking about maybe we need to do this in our yard here at the Graham home in Montpelier, but I just wanted to, so how high is this low tunnel? Do you have to crawl when you're in there, or is it that low, or how's that work?
Typically speaking, a low tunnel, it depends on the size of the hoops you create, but a typical low tunnel is about 2.5 feet off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not crawling underneath it, but you are simply lifting the fabric up off of it, which is
okay.
You know, very, very easy to do, the fabric or the plastic. So, yeah. So they are definitely low to the ground. They're not for crawling under.
Okay. I told you I was going to ask you some ignorant questions here. And that's... Yeah, and enough room for the plants, but not really for the gardener. I see. Okay.
There you go. You got it.
All right. And how big how large are your low tunnels? I mean, in terms of length and width and all that.
When I generally speaking, they're made to cover garden plots that are roughly 3 feet wide, which is basically the best width for a plot because you don't want it so wide that you have to step in the middle of it. So yep. Typically the cover plot is about 3 feet wide. When I do the training, I show people how to make one that's 10 feet long. Mm-hmm. I've got ones at home that are 16 feet long. I don't recommend too much longer than that because then it becomes a hassle for one person to lift up the covering and put it back. But you can definitely, you know, I mean, if you can go to other places, farms, commercial institutions where they use them, and you will see, you know, hundreds of feet of low tunnel. But for the home gardener, I'd say somewhere between 10, 15 feet long is probably about as long as you want to make them.
I see. Okay. And some of that would have to do with weight or just the general awkwardness. And there's probably some flexibility yeah. there where you don't want the thing to be drooping at the other end while you're trying to pick up the first end or whatever.
Well, you have hoops supporting the whole structure of the plastic, but yeah, it just becomes very cumbersome when it's too long for one person to handle. You could do
right,
it.
Okay.
It becomes cumbersome. And who has and in your backyard anyway?
That's true. Yeah. What? Talk to us a little bit about the about the materials. What do you use for the hoops, and then what's the covering?
Sure. The weakest hoops structure that you would use would be wire hoops, which are commercially available. You can get them at a lot of nurseries. They're great if you're using a very light fabric covering or row cover, specifically one that's used to keep pests off, as one of your earlier callers were mentioning. When you're going mm-hmm. to heavier fabric or using plastic, I recommend either using half-inch metal electrical conduit or half-inch PVC conduit. PVC is much easier to use and to bend. Metal obviously will last longer, and you don't have the environmental issues of PVC. But for the average home gardener, I think PVC is a very easy to use material for the hoop. And then in terms of the covering that you're going to put over it, you can buy either a heavier version of Remay or floating row cover. I know Gardener Supply sells it. They call it garden blankets. I also recommend 6 mil clear plastic, which you can get in Lowe's or any hardware store. And that is strong enough. It lasts a long time. It's thick enough that it really holds the heat very well, even though it still lets in enough light during the day to keep the plants growing. So those are your two basic elements, the PVC or metal conduit, and then your either row cover or plastic to cover it up. And
so now I want to attach the hoops. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, Dave, we totally have to bring you into our next hoop house class, our next low tunnel class.
Okay.
The way, if you're using metal for the hoops, you can just insert that directly into the ground. If you're using the PVC conduit, I recommend putting 2-foot pieces of metal rebar into the ground. You punch them in mm-hmm. 1 foot, and then the foot that sticks above the ground, you put the PVC conduit over that, and that holds it in place very sturdily.
Yeah, that sounds sort of that's the staking down. But in terms of attaching the plastic or the cover to the hoops, do you tape them, or are there little loops for that, or what's the drill there?
No, you're depending on gravity and the tension at either end of the hoop house. So on the two ends, you've gathered your plastic or row cover together, and you weigh it down, you know, with bricks or rocks. And you can also use bricks or rocks along the sides to hold it down. But you don't attach the covering to the hoops in any way. It's just held down over the hoops by weight.
Got it. Okay. Brett Halverson, some folks like the elevation of a raised bed. And I want to ask you about what are the advantages there, and if you were to walk me quickly through the project of building a raised bed, do that. What would I use, and what are the best techniques and so on?
Sure, yeah. So raised beds are a great way to get started if you're a beginning gardener. And, you know, typically you can build them yourself pretty easily, but there's also kits that, you know, places like Home Depot sell for as little as, you know, $40 a kit. And mm-hmm. they're typically between 4 inches wide and about 6 to 10 feet long. And if you're building it yourself, you want to be sure to line the bed if you're using treated wood so that the wood isn't leaking into the bed itself. And then you'll want to fill up the raised bed with a soil mix that has a good nutrient and water holding capacity. And typically about 10 to 20% of that should be compost. And you want to be sure to find a location where your raised bed will get about 6 to 8 hours of direct sunlight throughout the growing season. So those are kind of the basic steps to get started.
What's a good liner if you're using, as you say, treated wood, and you want to keep that away from the actual soil and compost of your raised bed?
Typically, folks use like a landscape fabric for the liner that you could just staple inside the bed.
Yeah, I see. Okay, that makes sense. And how high off the ground typically are raised beds, and what supports them from underneath?
They vary in height, but if you're building one in an area that gets a lot of traffic, you want to make it usually at least 10 inches high. And that just helps to, you know, keep the foot traffic out of the garden itself.
Yeah, that makes sense. It demarks it as a place where you'd have to take an extra effort to walk there. And so let's not do that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Typically, you don't want to walk on your garden bed because it compresses the soil down.
Right, right, and yeah, that's not a good thing, and of course, in terms of the dimensions of your raised bed, I heard Gordon a moment ago talk about beds in general wanting to be pretty much 3 feet wide at the widest, and I'm gathering that's mainly because you know, you want to be able to essentially reach fully through your garden bed, maybe. More easily from, you know, walking around the other side or whatever, but 3 feet is a good comfortable width. Is that right?
Yeah, typically I say 3 to 4 feet, and then you know, anywhere from 6 to 10 feet long is kind of the typical length of a garden bed.
Yeah, and so if someone actually is going to go get the lumber and build a raised bed, you said Home Depot has some of them for as little as $40. What's the overall budget, would you say, though, if you're really starting out from scratch and you're going to be getting some fabric and so on? I mean, what should you plan on for an expense here?
Well, if you're doing a kit, you know, anywhere from $40 to $100. And then I would say if you're building it yourself, it could get a little more expensive, maybe up to $150 or $200 for all the supplies. But we also have a new resource on our website where if you're looking for resources to get started with gardening, you can look on our map, and there's folks around the state that are willing to share resources with folks, because we recognize that not everybody has necessarily the money to or the resources to get started with gardening. So we have over 40 people listed on our map that are willing to share garden resources.
As a general rule, actually, when you talk about the sort of finances of gardening and so on, how much do you save on, I don't know, a typical family's diet of vegetables, gardening? You know, I don't know if anybody's done a study to determine what is typically spent by a gardener who's growing a lot of their own vegetables over the course of a season versus what it would cost to, you know, go down to the farmer's market or the supermarket and get a lot of this produce from by purchasing it just fully grown and so on. What do you have any sense of that?
You know, I don't really know exactly. It would be interesting to read more about that. But, you know, I think it's kind of an equation of time and money combined. So, you know, you also need to have the resource of time to grow a big garden and kind of, you know, how do you calculate what time costs you versus, you know, just the convenience of going somewhere to buy produce. But I think, the more that you grow your own veggies, the more likely you are to eat those veggies because they're fresh and they're, you know, more nutrient dense right when they're harvested. And I think also, you know, it encourages kids to eat more veggies because typically kids will eat veggies more often when they've grown them themselves. So I think there's a lot of other benefits to gardening that can't quite be calculated in a monetary sense.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to add on to what Fred was saying. That I think it's a mistake when people think about gardening, home gardening, and the first equation is like, well, how much money do you save? You know, it depends, you know, all the things Brett's saying about what your time is worth, but there are also extraordinary benefits to gardening, not least of which are the health benefits that come from being outside in sunshine and fresh air, of interacting with soil microbes, physical exercise. So there's a whole bunch of benefits that come from gardening in addition to having this incredibly nutritious food that you're much more likely to eat.
Well, that's a really good point as well. It overall, it's good for you. Get outside and do a little stretching and bending as you dig in your garden or weed your vegetables or whatever, and get a little exercise that way. And as you say, the fresh air and I think the general good feeling about connectedness with the earth and so on, you know, getting your hands in the soil is also there's probably a spiritual benefit or psychological benefit to that as well. So lots of aspects here, which are
absolutely. I think, and especially right now, there's, you know, a lot of uncertainty and stress for many people, and gardening is something we can enjoy and feel like we're in control of. And, you know, growing your own food also helps you to feel more secure in knowing where your food is coming from. And it's an easy, close-to-home activity that people can do during the quarantine. And, you know, gardens create a lot of beauty and meaning and sense of purpose in our lives.
Yeah, I think I've read that gardening is like the most popular hobby in America. Is that, do you have any data on that or whatever?
Yeah, there's a National Gardening Survey that came out a number of years ago that talked about the popularity of gardening and how it is one of the number one hobbies that people mention. And, you know, that occurs in all different forms. So, you know, some people are into veggie gardens and other people love their flower gardens and perennial gardens. So there's, you know, so many different aspects to gardening that people can get involved with. And, you know, that's one of the things that our Master Gardener course offers to people, is we have classes in all the different types of gardening. And it's pretty comprehensive and a great way to get started if you're looking to learn more about how to garden.
The other thing that's, I think is kind of cool about it is it's really scalable in terms of how much time and energy and et cetera you're gonna devote to it. You know, some people are happy with a couple of buckets of tomatoes growing in them. Other people want to get out there and build massive raised beds in their yards and devote every evening to in the summertime to working in the garden. And I'm sure there are many, many gradations in between. That's another aspect of it, is the kind of scalability of it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. There's all different forms of gardening. And I think, you know, if you're just starting out, starting small is the way to go. And then, you know, doing more and more as you learn more and as you access more resources.
Yeah. And I'm also curious in terms of the course on Master Gardening, if folks are interested in reaching out and signing up, what do they do, Brett Halverson?
Yeah, so they can reach out to us. Our website has more information about the course. It's uvm.edu/extension/mastergardener. And we keep a list of folks that are interested. Our sign up typically starts in November every year. And we usually have about 100, 115 students per class. And we also have Master Composter in the fall, and the sign-up for Master Composter is typically in August.
I see. Okay. Tell me a little bit about the if somebody's a non-gardener, let's say, and it's thinking, you know, I ought to take up gardening as a hobby. It would be all the benefits we were just talking about in terms of getting outside and growing some of my own vegetables and et cetera. Sounds appealing. I was just wondering, maybe the first stage isn't a Master Gardener class, because it sounds like you already want to be a journey person gardener. I'm sort of analogizing here to the trades. Before you go for a Master Gardener designation, are there more basic classes? I guess that would be one way to put the question.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, we offer hands-on classes in the summertime, so you could take part in some of those classes if you want to learn more about the program or just, you know, start learning some basic information. We also have a number of resources about vegetable gardening on our website. We have a new section called Gardening During COVID-19 that's focused on vegetable gardening and getting started with vegetable gardening if you're a beginner. So that's a great way to get involved. And then Gordon is working on a Victory Garden project right now that he can tell you more about, and he's going to be helping gardeners to start gardens.
Gordon, let's go there. I actually wanted to ask you about the Victory Garden project. What is that, and how's it? Just give us a sense of what. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, Victory Gardens is a term that most people know, whether or not they've actually participated or grown one in the past, and that's because of a long historical tradition in this country reaching back to World War II, World War I, and to the progressive education movement of the 1890s. Victory Gardens have a very positive connotation for most people, and generally speaking, they emerge in times of crisis. And unfortunately, that is a time that we are in right now. And I realize that's not the topic of the show, but it's important when we talk about gardening to understand where our food comes from. And that right now we're having a real, not only a pandemic in terms of the coronavirus, but we're starting to have an economic crisis and a food crisis that's associated with that. You know, I just heard the latest statistics. Actually, I was listening to the news on your segment on the half hour. And, you know, we're now up to over 30 million people who have just lost their jobs. I read articles in the Vermont Digger about how the Vermont National Guard just handed out 112,000 ready-to-eat meals in Rutland a couple days ago. Vermont Food Bank says that one in four Vermonters are now struggling with hunger issues. So not all of us see it, but there's a tremendous amount of hunger out there right now, and it is increasing. And Victory Gardens are a way that people can take some control over that problem and produce some of their own food. So that's why we have just started, as part of the UVM Master Gardener, we have just started the Vermont Victory Gardens project to help people who are suffering or impacted by food insecurity, who want to grow more of their own food, or to help community members who want to grow more food in community for people in where they live who need that food, whether they're donating it to a food bank or shelter or something like that. So it's a brand new project to help people who are impacted by food insecurity to produce some of their own food.
Well, it certainly sounds timely and it'd be a very important thing. And I kudos to both of you for working on this. I mean, obviously, we are in a very tough time right now. I'm wondering overall, Brett Halverson, if you could tell us how is gardening different this spring, given the coronavirus pandemic, than it has been in previous springs?
Yeah, we've definitely seen a lot of increased interest in gardening. We've received many inquiries through our helpline about vegetable gardening, also how to get started growing gardens for other people who are in need. We've seen an uptick in volunteers reactivating because they're interested in helping the community through gardening in some way. And then just a lot more students in the Master Gardener class this spring than we've ever had before. And requests for master gardeners to come out and teach classes about vegetable gardening to beginners. So we're definitely seeing a lot of interest. I think, like I said, people are at home looking for something to do outside. They're looking for the exercise and the meaning in their lives, and they're looking to, you know, create some more security for themselves around growing their own food and knowing where it comes from. So so it's really great to see the uptick in interest, and we really want to let everyone in Vermont know that we're here to help and help you find the information that you need. We have lots of free, reliable, research-based resources to help people get started. And like I said, we have these two great courses that we offer every year. We have the summertime classes. And we also have master gardeners around the state that are willing to help. So we want to be here as a resource for people.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, do you have a sense that if Vermonters suddenly decided en masse to really get serious about gardening and, you know, step it up in a way that's much greater than it has been in recent times. I'm wondering, how close could we come to replacing? And let's assume at the same time that really we really do start to see, given the economic dislocations of the COVID-19 crisis, we really do start to see, you know, empty produce sections in supermarkets. Could we actually grow our way out of that problem?
The problem of hunger in America is a huge problem even before the COVID-19 crisis, and it would require a show all of its own to discuss. That being said, clearly, historically, Victory Gardens are a way that people can produce a significant amount of their own food. And the stat that a lot of people will read about is that at the height of the Victory Garden movement, which is like 1943, 1944, there were an estimated 20 million home gardens in the United States. And that's at a period where there are only about 35 million households. So an extremely high proportion of people were growing their own food, and it's further estimated that between 9 and 10 million tons of fruit and vegetables were grown in these gardens, which was roughly equivalent to 40% of all the fruit and vegetables that Americans ate that year. So the reality is, yes, if Vermonters, if Americans, and specifically Vermonters really set their mind to it, if a lot of us got involved in this, we could clearly produce a significant amount of the food that we eat here in Vermont.
Well, that is fascinating, and I think it's something that folks ought to be thinking about it. If you aren't currently an active gardener, maybe this is something to think about taking up as a way to use some of the time, because as we all know, in the current economic situation, a lot of us have more time than we are used to having. So that's one way to put it to good use, and certainly something worth thinking about. If folks want to reach out and learn more from the two of you and the UVM Extension, Brett Halverson, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, everyone can reach out by either going to our website, again, that's uvm.edu/extension/mastergardener, or you can call the helpline if you have any gardening questions, and you can leave a message. The helpline number is 802-656-5421. You can also fill out a form if you have a question on our website, and Master Gardeners are answering emails from home right now, so we'll get back to you as soon as we can. And the helpline is also a great resource for anybody that has a gardening question at any time. It's staffed by Master Gardeners who volunteer to answer questions, and it's a great resource if you're just getting going.
All right. Well, Brett Halverson and Gordon Clark of the UVM Extension Service, thank you so much for joining us, and it's great talking with you. Happy growing out there. Stay healthy, and we'll perhaps talk again soon.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for having us.
All righty. Let's go to the top of the hour here, which means the end of today's Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of our program. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. Have a good afternoon, everybody. Wash your hands. Stay healthy. We'll